Welcome to the American Reformer Podcast, hosted by Josh Abatoy and Timon Klein. Our mission is to promote a vigorous Christian approach to the cultural challenges of our day, rooted in the rich tradition of Protestant social and political thought.
Welcome back, everyone, to the American Reformer Podcast. One of your usual co-hosts here, Timon Klein, Editor-in-Chief, and I have with me in the cockpit Jesse Rhine, who's the Executive Director of the Center for Academic Faithfulness and Flourishing. And we're joined by a special guest we've been wanting to have on the show for a while, Dr. Jonathan Master, who many of you may know, but those of you who don't know is President of Greenville Presbyterian Theological Seminary. Jonathan, thanks so much for joining us today to talk to us. And we always ask guests to give a brief bio of themselves. Give us your background of how you got to Greenville and your professional and personal experience to get there.
Yeah, Timon, Jesse, thanks so much for this invitation. It's hard to know where to start. There's a sense in which when I look back at how I got to Greenville, there are so many ways in which the Lord prepared me for this going back to my earliest days. And so I don't probably want to start there, but I'll give the last maybe 10 years. I served as a pastor for a long time and I'm ordained. Yeah, and my ordination is in the PCA. And so I'd served in several churches. And for about 10 years, not quite 10 years, but about 10 years leading up to my coming to Greenville, I was serving as Dean of the School of Divinity and a professor of theology at Cairn University. I had a couple other roles there, but those are the main ones, Dean of the School of Divinity. And then was also serving in churches when I had the opportunity, but not full time. And so it was a couple of years before I ended up here that Greenville, unbeknownst to me, was beginning to think about a presidential transition. And one of my good friends, Ian Hamilton, whom I'd known for about 15 years, approached me and talked to me about the position. I wasn't terribly familiar with Greenville Seminary at that time. I knew some faculty members. I knew some alumni, but it was a little bit outside of my orbit. But eventually, they came around and asked me to think about it and to sort of throw my hat in the ring, as it were. And one thing led to another, and there's about a year long process. And it was a really, I'm really grateful for the way it went, because since it kind of came out of nowhere for me, I felt total freedom to explain as clearly as I could who I was and what my priorities were. And I think they felt the same kind of freedom. You'd hope that you'd always be that way in an interview setting, but it doesn't always work that way. And so the way I explain it to people is I sort of felt like I was playing with house money the whole time. And the Lord just worked in such a way that there was a deep compatibility between myself and the search committee. So when they finally narrowed down to me and asked me to consider it and extended the call, it was a really easy choice. And so we moved in 2020, right kind of at the beginning of the COVID craziness, and have been here now over 3 years, not quite four.
Jonathan, I'm really interested in hearing a little bit more about the seminary's founding and some of its principles, purposes, its overall mission. I'm particularly struck by the three points of emphasis that Greenville has on being biblically grounded, pastorally focused, and confessionally faithful. Could you take each of those commitments and explain kind of one by one what that means in practice?
Sure. Yeah, so going back to the founding just very briefly, the seminary was founded in 1987 by PCA ruling elders who were concerned about the drift that they perceived in seminary education broadly within mostly the PCA. I mean, that was their world. And they were concerned about a couple of things. They were concerned about what they saw in terms of diminishing academic standards. I think particularly related to the languages, when you read those early minutes, they were worried about the fact that those were being de-emphasized. And then they were also concerned about some issues of doctrinal drift and fidelity to the confession. So those three taglines that you mentioned, Jesse, are our way of trying to encapsulate what we're about. And the way I always start when I explain it is to say, one of the things you have to understand about Greenville is we exist to train pastors. And that seems very obvious. But in fact, actually, seminaries tend to do a lot more than that and get into all kinds of other areas. And we do remain focused on training pastors. And what that means, and that kind of hits with the pastorally focused tagline that you mentioned, what that means is for us, among other things, we're training men to preach, to handle the word of God in public and in private. And we're also explicit about the fact that we are here to train certain kinds of men. That is to say, personal piety and their growth in godliness is of equal importance to us as their academic qualifications, which are also very important. So they need to be well trained, and they need to have all these tools to be able to handle God's word well. But they also need to grow and be challenged to grow in certain kinds of ways. So, biblically grounded, what we tend to emphasize there is are those academic tools that we it should. You know, one of the taglines that I used internally, we never really said this externally, was, you know, it should be hard. This kind of training should be rigorous. It involves deep study of Greek and Hebrew. Our MDiv is 124 credit hours. That's a long MDiv. And but that's because we want to turn out men who are not just willing, but who are able and who are rightly handling the word of truth. We want workers, but what we really want is approved workers. And so that's what we emphasize when we talk about biblically grounded. Pastorally focused, I already touched on, but there's another aspect to that as well, which is since we've been pastorally focused from the beginning, our trustees took a very distinctive approach, which they still take today, which is we have been adamant about the fact that this education needs to be affordable. So our cost per credit hour is extraordinarily low, and we have a number of scholarships in addition to that, because we are grateful to the Lord to be able to say that none of our men have had to incur any debt to study here. But that goes along with being pastorally focused, because we're turning out men who are going to, Lord willing, serve the church, we hope, for decades, and we want them to be free to do that. Too often I hear stories of men who graduate from seminary. I've known men like this, graduate from seminary, and they want to serve as pastors, but for just very basic financial reasons, they can't. And it comes back to their seminary studies. And then confessionally faithful just refers to the fact that we are transparent about our convictions. We want to be clear about the fact that the churches we serve are churches that subscribe to the Westminster standards, and whether they all do it in an equally robust way or not, we're committed to being just open about our convictions. The standards are our confession of faith. And so every year, our trustees and our faculty members, both in writing and verbally in public, state very clearly their adherence to those standards. So that's the content that fills out those basic taglines. But obviously, there's a lot more underneath each one of those.
Yeah, I'm just curious, Jonathan, when you're talking about the curriculum and intentionally making it rigorous and difficult, you know, to be a challenge, almost a bit of a weeding out process, you know, if you're going to go through this, you have to be serious. How do you think about, you know, that approach in the current environment when so many other seminaries have moved towards, in you know, the past decade, towards reducing MDiv requirements, or maybe all degree requirements, for the purpose of, you know, I don't want to accuse them of trying to be degree mills, but for a lot of the things you're bringing up, cost benefit analysis, time, going remote instead of residential, and then, you know, I think probably encountering a lot of applicants that just can't handle the more robust curriculum and its demands. So in terms of sort of the marketplace of seminaries, you know, how do you think about Greenville's place in that, and has its fealty or kind of commitment to this rigor you know, borne the kind of fruit that you hoped it would on both fronts, both the quality of people you're getting and then also, you know, how the graduates perform and how they're able to handle their pastoral ministry.
There are definitely market pressures. You're right. We're conscious of the fact that we're swimming upstream. One of the commitments I made to the board, because it's deeply held for me, is that what we were going to do is just continually make the case. Sometimes I would argue that some of these things are lost just because it requires making a case. And so if you look at our video content, even our web content, those kinds of things, we're constantly both explicitly and implicitly making the case for this. I will say with respect to market pressures as well, though, we are at an advantage, and I consider myself very blessed by the Lord to be part of this heritage because since our board was committed from the beginning to making tuition costs low, they did that primarily to help the students so that graduates wouldn't have a burden of debt. But the other effect that it had, and I'm not even sure they were conscious of this when the seminary was founded, but the other effect that it had is that because our budget isn't based on tuition, it's a very, very small percentage of our budget is based on tuition. So we really have a great deal of administrative freedom to stick to our guns, so to speak, and to continue to remain committed to the curriculum that we think best represents the both what the Bible would demand, but also what the best examples from our heritage show us. So our curriculum was originally modeled after that of Old Princeton, and there have been changes since then, but in terms of the rigor, that hasn't really changed. And again, I'm conscious of the fact that I'm in a very blessed position because we don't feel some of those market pressures. Now, on the other hand, what that means is we have to raise the money every year. But in terms of tuition dollars, we're not too dependent on that. You asked about traction with students. What we have seen in the last 3 years is each year a record number of applicants, and we turn, you know, a number of applicants down, but then a record number of enrollees as well. And I think this fall is going to, I mean, I was saying to someone today, looking at the numbers, it's possible. I don't know whether this will happen. It's possible our on-campus number could double just next year. I mean, half our students this year are first year students. And all that to say, it has really gained traction. This message that we've, I think, believed in since long before I got here, but maybe we've been a little bit more forward with it in the last few years in terms of making the case, has really resonated with students. And it certainly resonates with churches. I'll tell you one other thing that I think speaks to the question of its value. I think it was the first year I was here, maybe 6 months in, I asked the folks who deal with our alumni, what percentage of our MDiv graduates are still in pastoral ministry? And they brought back the number, and I didn't believe it, so I had them run it again. And then I still couldn't believe it. I thought they had gotten the math wrong. And then I sat in the room while they went through the names. And our persistence rate throughout the history of our seminary from MDiv graduates in pastoral ministry is about 92%. And to put that in perspective, the latest numbers, and Jesse, you'll probably be familiar with these. It was a Duke University study that just was released, I think, in the fall, of MDiv graduates within 5 years, there's only an 18% persistence rate. The numbers I was familiar with were from about 10 years before that, and they were a little higher than that. They still weren't good. They were higher than 18, but ours is 92%. And so I don't, you know, that's ultimately the grace of God. But if you want to talk about human factors, I think the rigor of the training has to be part of that equation, just like it would be in any other field that we might want to look at.
Yeah, I would say the you know, rigor of the training, and then again the types of people attracted to that. I mean, that has to go hand in hand. And I do seem to perceive that, you know, there was a time when the move towards doing much more online or doing much more in this sort of expedited style was gaining some popularity. And then probably a myriad factors, but certainly post-COVID, anecdotally, people I talk to, especially young men, they want to do something, you know, real. They want to be there. They want it to be challenging. It's just sort of been a sea change for various reasons. And so I think that is what a lot more people want, but it's also the people you want to be there. Sort of piggybacking on that, you mentioned, you know, this retention rate, we could say, of pastors at churches or staying in the ministry. I think what a lot of people want to know about seminaries, especially denominationally rooted ones, is what's the relationship in this case with presbyteries? You know, what's the feedback and the back and forth or interaction with presbyteries between Greenville and themselves?
Well, the way it works in the PCA, there's only one PCA seminary that's directly supported by the denomination. And we don't just serve the PCA, but I'm just starting there because we were founded by PCA ruling elders. So we're not directly supported financially by any denomination, but we send out all of our information to all the denominations we serve. We have trustee representation from the denominations that we serve. And so we welcome their oversight. Some denominations are very good about that. They will contact us and say, we want to come and sit down with your professors. We want to sit in on classes. We want to see these documents. And we are glad to offer them that kind of oversight. Not every denomination is equally vigilant in those ways, but we'd be glad if they were. And we're doing everything we can to try to not just begrudgingly accept the oversight that we're given, but to welcome it. And so we'd be happy with even greater levels of engagement, but we try to engage as much as we can with every presbytery in which our men serve and certainly every denomination in which they serve that aligns with our theological convictions. And so, you know, again, it's a bit of a mixed bag, but I would say on our end, we are open to that. We do not see ourselves as above the church. The way I look at it, and I explain this to people, I look at it as we've been given a very narrow brief by the church to train men for her ministry, and we're aiming to do that faithfully and well. And if the church as a whole were to ask us questions about that, you know, how could we not answer them? All our professors have served at least for 5 years as pastors. They're all ordained teaching elders in their denominations, and so they're still under the direct oversight of presbyteries as well. And our men, many of them are under care while they're here. So there are a number of ways in which it works out at a local level, and then at a regional church level, and at a denominational level. And so we want to do as much of that as we can.
I'd like to just pause for a quick second and, as a scholar of higher education, step back and say just how unique this model is, so that our listeners have some context. Typically at the large mainline Protestant divinity schools and seminaries, you have very large endowments, but you have smaller student bodies. At the evangelical colleges, and again, this is painting with somewhat of a broad brush, but there are general trends here. Evangelical Protestant seminaries typically have much larger student populations, but they're heavily tuition dependent. The resources aren't quite as large as what you have at the main lines. What's interesting to me is that Greenville essentially is growing its student population, but it's not paying for that through tuition dependence. And there's a commitment to raise external dollars to ensure that students do not have a large debt burden. And that, combined with the highly residential and rigorous program, tends to prepare students so that whenever they are out in pastoral ministry, they persist. And the relationship with the presbyteries enables the seminary to provide very good kind of matchmaking, so that you know your students, you know the presbyteries, you're able to help them as they're trying to discern a particular call. So it seems to me that this is quite unique, and I just wonder, as being situated in that place, what would you say about kind of in terms of leading institutions like this? What particular lessons have you learned just in your time there, and how would you encourage other seminary presidents to lead so that you could serve the church well?
Well, I want to be. I don't know everyone's particular situation, so I want to be careful about offering advice. Sometimes people ask me comparative questions, and I try to just say, "Look, I have problems in my own house. That's what I'm charged with dealing with. I'm not here to run at any other institutions because I don't know all the ins and outs. But I think the things that I've tried to think about are, number one, leading by making the case. And recognizing that that's part of the role is to make the case. I, on a positive level, in terms of encouragement, what I have found is what you just described, Jesse, and I think you articulated it really clearly in terms of our model, really does resonate with the people of God, that God's people get that. They understand why that model is important and why that is a healthy one for the future pastors that are going to serve our churches. And so both churches and individuals have really responded to it. So I'm always overwhelmed actually with gratitude for our donors, our constituents, because it's a big ask to say, because we don't have a substantive endowment that funds us. So it's a year by year kind of thing, but the Lord has really been kind in raising up people. So I would both say, by way of encouragement, I think people do get this and get behind it. And also, I would say, having said that, though, it's certainly not what's in the air. And so you have to make the case for it and just recognize that that's going to have to be done. So, and that's true of prospective students too. I mean, they're being one of the first conversations I have with prospective students when they come to visit is, look, I don't have to tell you this because you're being told this already. There are easier ways for you to do this. There are faster ways for you to do this. There are ways that are less intrusive to your life than what we're laying before you. But let me try to articulate why it is that I think this is important for you. And so it's the same way with constituents. I don't know if that fully answers your question, Jesse, but those are the lessons that I think about a lot.
Yeah, it seems to me that when you have student outcomes that are so remarkable, having a 92% lifetime ministry placement rate, it's an easier case to make both to the student on the front end that we're going to prepare you well and we're going to help place you in a good fit. But then also in terms of fundraising, to go out and ask God's people to provide resources so that you can train students for the ministry, they know that there's going to be a very high likelihood that the contribution they're making is going to directly impact the local church.
Yeah, that's a great point. I mean, some of our donors are really thinking that way, And I, of course, we welcome this, because when they're giving their, dollar, they're really giving it to support the training and the service of pastors in the future. I mean, that's what they're doing ultimately. And if I say to them, you're giving this dollar, but actually only 18 cents of it is going to a pastor who will serve beyond 5 years, And they actually aren't going to be even that well trained, even though they're still in it, that's not terribly compelling. I think you're right. I think that those numbers do really speak to something important in terms of being a wise steward of the resources that the Lord's entrusted to us.
Jonathan, what kind of, we're talking about the church on this end and kind of the outcomes But back, you know, stepping back a bit to the, and you were talking, you know, kind of the sales pitch, if you will, that you give to students. This is going to be really hard for you, but you should come here. What about, you know, when they're in their studies? You know, I did seminary and I knew a lot of guys who, you know, really had to sacrifice a lot just to be there, which I think most of them would say, they looking back on it, they appreciate, you know, it's sort of character building. But what was really important to them is to be around, you know, seminary professors that they admired, as well as their, you know, their peers. And that also is part of the formation. You know, that's some of the best times at seminary are, you know, in the hallway, arrogantly debating stuff you just read about, you know. So all of that, I think, is part of the process. What's the student experience like at Greenville in terms of the feedback you get and you know, from classes all the way to just being around?
When I came here, like I said, I wasn't really familiar with the seminary. I don't think, maybe I'd been here once, but I hadn't really spent any time at the seminary. And it immediately struck me as very different in a positive way. And I've been to a bunch of other places, but it's even in our faculty expectations that and the faculty handbook that they're the expectation is you're coming here to serve these students, and therefore you need to exercise hospitality. You need to get to know them. You need to be available to them. I mean, there are all these sort of granular ways that we get at that. But the bottom line is it really is in the floorboards here. And I noticed it right away. So it is very normal for students to be in professors' homes and to certainly to be in their offices, and professors have students that they pray with every week. And so there's a fairly, I would say, very robust interwoven with all that those curricular ideas we were talking about earlier, sense that no, we're here to train these men in a certain way. Samuel Miller, who is the second professor at Princeton, I may botch the quote slightly, but said something like, the combination of academic preparation with the formation in personal piety is the great genius of the Reformed Seminary, something like that. But the point is to say, and this is, you know, early Princeton is replete with these references. All that is to say that you have to combine these two things. And it's one of the reasons why we require our professors to have been pastors, not just so that they can give kind of real world illustrations, although that can be valuable, but because we really want professors who think in that way and who are used to looking at people from a shepherding perspective, because we think that's a vital part of what being a professor in a seminary is about. I'll just give a little anecdote and then maybe answer the question more. There were about 8 months between the time that I was announced as the president and when I actually moved here. And Dr. Pipa, who is my predecessor, and I talked on the phone a number of times throughout that 8 months. And one of the things that he said to me early on, and I didn't quite understand it, but I began to understand it, and I think I do now, is he said, you just have to remember we're a seminary, not a graduate school of theology. And at first I thought, what does that mean? Does that mean, you know, it's not graduate level of education? I knew it couldn't be that because I knew him well enough to know that wasn't what he was about, but I wasn't sure. But I started to understand it. We're training men for gospel ministry, and we're training men as gospel ministers ourselves. And so that level of deep personal involvement, which can't always be spelled out in a curriculum, has to be a part of what we're doing, and not just offering graduate classes that happen to be in biblical studies or Greek or Hebrew or theology. And so I think that we beat that drum all the time, and it really is in the fabric of the place, and every professor understands that and embodies that. I will also say one last thing about the student experience that I didn't know when I came here, and it's probably distinctive. Greenville, South Carolina, in God's providence, has this and Jesse will know this, has this, almost staggering concentration of healthy Reformed churches. It's just, it's a place unlike any place I've ever been. And what that means for our students is that there are any number of congregations that I can point to and say, go there, sit under that preaching, watch that session, and that will shape you. And they all do that in different congregations. And so that's something that isn't directly attributable to the seminary, although I guess there are some connections there, but it's certainly not a curricular thing. And it's not even really about our professors so much as it is just in God's providence. Greenville is a great place for ministerial training because of that local church environment.
I thought Jesse was going to say something there. It was frozen for a minute. That's fantastic. I mean, some of my best memories were going to, you know, seminary professors' houses after church and getting to, you know, just do other things with them. And those are the people that I did that with are the ones I still talk to, you know, today, and still admire them. So I think it's an underrated aspect of that. And it probably used to be, or it was, did used to be, you know, a part even of undergraduate education. But it's even less so, certainly not at most undergraduate institutions now. And it's also not at a lot of seminaries. So, I mean, I would say that to me, that is a huge selling point, or should be, for prospective students. And as well as, you know, you said it's providential, but it's part of the ethos there. That amount of, you know, really good churches, you know, I was told early in seminary to be a sermon junkie, you know, to like go listen to preaching as much as possible, which is not everybody's cup of tea, but I imagine if you're going to do any preaching, it probably should be. And it's, you know, you get way more doing that than you do just if you only went to your homiletics class or whatever. So these are all really good things. And some of them are, you know, just part of the place God has placed Greenville, but there's obvious challenges for all theological educational models, including Greenville and everybody else. Some places are already succumbing to that. So what are the challenges you see for seminaries that are unique to them, not just higher ed generally, and although you can mention those as well, and kind of piggybacking off of that, you know, you've mentioned Old Princeton a lot because we all venerate it as for what it used to be. And it's not that now, you know, I've been there. Right. It's a disaster, even though it has a fantastic endowment that covers a multitude of sins, you know, but the substance, it's physically empty. It really is. It's gorgeous, but it's physically empty. And you know, no fidelity to what it was founded to be. So how do seminaries approach the unique challenges for them over the next, let's say, decade, 20 years, whatever time frame we want, but then also on the back end, not, you know, something great can become what Princeton is now, you know, given a long enough timeline. So those are both sort of two ditches, you know, that seminaries have to deal with now.
I think our greatest challenges are always going to be the spiritual ones. You mentioned Princeton, but there are a number of other places we could mention it. And that's where the important declension is seen. So to think about that, we have to think about just the normal teaching we'd give on spiritual faithfulness. And so we need to let him who thinks he stands take heed lest he fall. I mean, this could happen to any of us, and there are just dozens of ways, if not hundreds of ways, that seminaries can go off track, and we're human too. We're susceptible to that. So I do think spiritual fidelity has to be your top concern, and there are a lot of ways that can get chipped away at. There are some obvious doctrinal deviations that could take place where you sort of hedge on certain things or turn a blind eye to your confessional commitments because this particular professor is worth it or whatever. And then there are ways in which you can de-emphasize the spiritual life of students or the spiritual life of professors. Again, turning a blind eye to your own sins or the sins of people that are close to you or in your mind bring something else to the table. And that's death to an institution. But I think in terms of more, I don't know, sort of market forces, if you will, I think, you know, it's difficult because if you're a tuition-driven model, what I've seen, and we've seen some pretty big examples of this, even in the last 5 years. When you expand in order to attract students, and there are ways to scale up online that initially seem very attractive, asynchronous education, where you're kind of making videos and putting them out there, that's an easy way to scale up and potentially boost tuition revenue. The problem, there are a number of problems. One problem that's the most important one is, I'm not sure that trains men to be pastors, but secondly, you can expand your program offerings, and then you become dependent on those programs. And sometimes those programs have a very short shelf life. And this is one of the stories that maybe hasn't been told as clearly about the struggles that some very large seminaries have had. They built programs to capture market share, and they kind of burned through the market share. And then what? Because you've built a budget model that's dependent on that tuition revenue. So I think the tuition revenue issue is a huge one, and it can lead you down all kinds of false trails. But I also think if you expand and do try to do 100 things, then it will inevitably have an effect on the ethos and even the education that each individual student experiences. So it's, you know, just to put it in a really, give a really obvious example, if I have a first year MDiv class that also has, you know, that half the students in it are actually, and I'm going to preface this by saying, not that there's anything wrong with this, but that also is, you know, 50% women studying for a counseling degree. And I'm glad that there are counseling degrees, so don't get me wrong. But if my first year MDiv class, it is split that way, it's a different class. It just is a different class. And so I think that's a real challenge. It's not easy to combine rigorous focused training in one thing with three other things. I mean, that just, that's going to change the dynamic. So those are things that I think are really difficult challenges. But like I said, I think so mission clarity then becomes so important. But at the end of the day, our biggest enemy, you know, our biggest concerns should be the sin in our own hearts, and we need to be attentive to that.
If I could just chime in on that just for 1 second, the analogy I always think of in this, and you articulated, I think this perfectly, but analogously, if everybody remembers the famous debate with Mark Dever, Mark Driscoll, and James McDonald 10 years ago about church models, right? And so Dever is obviously coming from a position of, well, this is what the church is, therefore its practice and its focus should look like this. And you could say by analogy that the other two guys, you know, for multi-site, media-driven, we would say, you know, curriculum, we're translating into that, it's this different type of model that's meeting demand and market share at the time. And over time, we saw which model is sustainable and has longevity. And I would say there's something to it on this side of things as well that parallels that kind of insight that everyone saw over time. And all to your point, there was also spiritual failing on the other side and not the other. And both of those things came together. And, you know, those alternative models that looked really successful for a while and had a lot of draw have proved, you know, the fruit is proven what was really kind of underneath. So I think about that a lot for both of these things. But Jesse, go ahead. Sorry.
Yes, I just I really appreciate the focus on the spiritual and the understanding that ultimately mission fidelity comes down to our own commitments to Christ and to His Word, and you know, as you said, we need to take heed lest we too shall fall. As I think a little bit about how mission fidelity is kind of built into the institution structurally, there are a couple of things that you've shared that, you know, as I tick off on my mind, the different factors I would consider, the financial model clearly is not pushing you in certain directions that might cause you to compromise your mission. The curriculum, there's a strong commitment to a rigorous, robust four-year program. That's another area where as curricular offerings are trimmed and requirements are reduced, that the institution can be drawn off its mission. There are three other areas that you touched on a bit with faculty, how the faculty experience at Greenville is much different than at a graduate theological school or divinity school. I wonder if you might be able to say a bit about kind of how faculty are evaluated and how they're expected to allocate their time. And for comparison, a graduate theological divinity school, there would be a strong emphasis on producing peer-reviewed research in addition to teaching, but that would probably be minimized, and also some service to the profession. And the other two factors that I'd love for you to say a few words about, how do you screen students, and what do you expect of them in terms of their commitments and how they approach their studies? And then finally, tell us a little bit about your board. I'm curious how they're also engaged in the institution and what's required of them.
Yeah, those are great questions. So with the faculty, we've had a remarkable longevity on our faculty. And so there's a sense in which some of these, it's not like we're cycling through faculty members on a particularly rapid basis. But I would say that in addition to all the kind of standard metrics that you have for faculty members, where you have student evaluations and you look at their, and they write up at the end of each year a kind of record of their scholarship and their writing and their speaking and that kind of stuff. And we do all that stuff, and that's a piece of it. But there's another element that's probably a little bit of a softer measure that just has to do with whether they're fulfilling the obligations that we consider to be important for a seminary professor. And this gets back to what I was talking about earlier. So I think our faculty evaluations would look fairly similar in some ways on paper, but then there's this kind of added element that, and if you were to come to our faculty meetings, what you'd find, Jesse, is that probably, I don't know the percentage, it varies from meeting to meeting, but a good percentage of the meeting is the faculty members praying for the students, praying for one another. I mean, so in other words, I think we would all see this as first and foremost a spiritual exercise and an extension of our ordination vows. And that's certainly how I would articulate it, that I'm a teaching elder in the PCA, and this is in God's providence the calling that I have by the church. But it's an extension of my being an ordained teaching elder in the PCA. And then that actually also leads into that other element, which is we all have oversight from our presbyteries. In terms of student screening, you know, we do require them to have their session, or not all of them are Presbyterians, but their elder board, or at least their pastor, answer some pretty extensive questions about how suitable they think they are for pastoral ministry. So in other words, we don't just want, and we get a lot of applicants who fit this description, guys who are interested in theology, maybe they've been reading stuff online, getting involved in that. That's great. Sometimes the Lord uses that as an important entry point, but they're not really involved in the church, and no session has ever said, I think you'd make a good pastor. And so we screen that out. And we want the involvement of their local church as at early level and then as much as possible throughout. We also ask the students pretty in many cases pretty personal questions. So we have all the other I'm sort of taking this for granted. We do the academic screening and their transcripts and all that stuff, but we're asking them some pretty personal questions. I would say that we also will turn students down or at least defer them because of ongoing struggles that they're having that would basically make them, and it's not that we're trying to discourage them, but it would basically, if we were sitting in a presbytery exam and we knew this about them, we'd say, you know, brother, you're not suited for pastoral ministry at this time. And so we kind of do that, what would be almost an exam committee screening at the beginning. So it takes a little while. And then they go through, they do that typically with our admissions director, but then oftentimes our academic dean or our dean of students will get involved just because it gets to be delicate and there are always particular situations. So we do the normal academic stuff, writing samples and papers from their undergraduate and their grades and all that. But then we do an additional level that more closely resembles what you might get if you were sitting with, six or eight ministers in a presbytery exam with respect to character. And then also there's the element of their church. The trustees, all our trustees are elders. They're either teaching elders or ruling elders in the churches that we serve that also hold to our confessional standards. And the reason why I qualify it in that way is we'll have Baptist students come to us, which is great. But they're not, they don't subscribe to the Westminster standards in their entirety. And so all our trustees would need to do that. We try to get a spread of trustees from the different denominations that we serve, which goes back to the oversight question you asked earlier. So all our trustees are ruling and teaching elders. All our trustees every year in writing reaffirm. I have a file in my desk, reaffirm their full commitment to the Westminster standards. And then in terms of the expectations for the trustees, it varies. Some of them participate in committees which are a little bit more time intensive. Some of them have helped us with fundraising. Some of them do all kinds of different things. But they're I answer to them and report to them twice a year.
So if we could pivot a bit and think about the future. So we've talked a bit about where Greenville is right now and what it represents, some of the wider challenges in theological education in the U.S. I'm curious what ambitions the seminary might have for the future. Where do you think the seminary will be a decade from now, and in what ways do you think it'll stay the same, and how might it evolve in the future?
In the most important ways, I see my job as preserving something and conserving something. So in the most important ways, our emphasis on personal piety, our curricular commitments, our close ties with the church, our responsiveness to the church, all those things, if they change, that's a failure, not a success. I think that if the Lord continues to bless us with more students, we're actually going to be pretty soon in an interesting position where we'll have to really take stock. And this will be a trustee level decision because number one, our facility only has a certain capacity, but the facility is a small matter. The real thing is it's very difficult for us to find faculty members who meet the criteria that I outlined earlier, who are committed to that kind of education, who have both the academic qualifications and the pastoral qualifications, who are committed to our doctrinal standards in the way that we are. All those things are actually surprisingly difficult to find. And so I think what we'd have, and we're committed to professors being very involved in our students' lives, which means a certain ratio. So there could come a point I could foresee in the next 5 years where we'd basically have to make a big picture decision, which is, I don't think the decision will be, do we move to a different model? I wouldn't be able to stick around if that's what we're going to do. But I don't think that will be the decision. I think the decision will be, can we scale up in terms of faculty and facilities in the way that we need to in order to keep doing the education that we're committed to, keep training men in the way that we're committed to training them, but on a larger scale? I would be thrilled if the answer to that question were yes, if we really could, with integrity, meet a larger student population. And the reason why I'd be thrilled is I pray every day, as I hope most listeners would, that the Lord of the harvest raises up workers for the harvest field, and not just workers, but as I've said, approved workers who have no need to be ashamed. So I want to see more men trained, but I believe in the kind of training that we're doing. I think it fits the best of our historical model, and I think it's biblically faithful. And so that's an non-negotiable. So I don't know the answer, Jesse, but I think that's going to be the challenge, is preserving the model, preserving our commitments. If the Lord were to raise up more laborers who say, that's how I believe I ought to be trained and need to be trained.
Fantastic. Jonathan, as we're sort of beginning to wrap things up here, as we're coming up on the hour, and you've been generous with your time, but just a sort of a couple questions at the end. One, you know, you've talked a lot about, I think, this, you know, wonderful sort of screening process you go through with applicants to make sure on the front end, which I think also should, if people are listening that are in churches, should strengthen confidence, you know, in the graduates being produced, that there is something, you know, there's a screening process on the front end, not just requirements to get out of there before they go to a church. But what would you say to, you know, undergrad students, or, you know, guys that maybe they're done with undergrad but are now wanting to go into ministry and are looking for seminary? What can they do sort of that stage, one, to think about Greenville, but two, also to prepare themselves well so that they're the type of person that Greenville wants, you know, to come to them?
That's a great question. I know I've said this on to a number of the questions, but it's because I don't know how else to answer. Primarily, I would say, take seriously your growth in personal piety. I mean, take seriously. Do you pray? Are you involved in your church? Are you faithful to your wife? Are you thinking biblically about your family and about your other obligations? I mean, these are the things that make or break a man. My colleague Ryan McGraw says, before we are Christian ministers, we have to be Christian men. And I think that's where you need to start and say, what does it look like for me to be a faithful, godly Christian man wherever the Lord has placed me? Now, you know, what guys usually mean when they ask that is, you know, well, what Greek textbook are you going to use in the first year? I can give you that. I mean, and we can send you the first year curriculum and get you the textbooks and so that you can read ahead. But there's wisdom in that. We do that usually the summer before guys come. But the bottom line is, you know, would your wife, would your pastor, would your elders know, you know, would your elders, do they know who you are, and they see you as a man who's growing in godliness and in grace and who's concerned about the gospel and concerned about the glory of Christ? That's what you want to be fueling your life. And the Lord will honor that wherever He takes you, whether He takes you into a different field, which might He might see fit to do to glorify Himself, or whether He sets you apart as an ambassador of Christ in that formal ordained work. So that's really what it means. And again, I think that oftentimes when the question is asked, those things are almost assumed. Well, yeah, I mean, I'm a good guy, so what books should I read? Well, no. Let's drill into that a little bit, because when you look at the qualifications for elders or overseers in the New Testament, the vast majority of them have to do with your personal character.
Excellent. Well, and on that note, similarly, you know, people, not just applicants, but people who want to learn more about Greenville, whether they're elders, donors, whatever, and supporting your work there, you know, where do you want to direct them, both contact-wise and to get a sense of, from a distance, you know, other than this podcast, of course, what Greenville's about? What should they go look at?
The website is probably the easiest entry point, gpts.edu, and it has a lot of information, but also has some videos that are our attempt at articulating some of these things. On the front page, there are two significant videos that try to articulate what we're after. And then throughout the web page or website and various pages, we have some additional materials. They can always contact any of us And those that information should be on the website as well. But I think that's the easiest. If for some reason our listeners are you know, want more information, there are ways to access more information from there. Also, if you know someone who's graduated, or if you that's always a good way to get firsthand, you know, what was it really like to study there kind of information. But I think the website's the best entry point.
When I will say, the last time I looked at the website, you can tell me if it's not this way anymore. I think it's in the about section. You know, there's a description, a message from you, but then the entire confession right there. You don't even need to go to a different website to read it. And it's well structured. It doesn't just say we subscribe to the Westminster Confession. It has the whole confession. And I think that's fantastic. So that gives you a sense of what Greenville's about, like Jonathan's been talking about. But Jesse, did you have any parting thoughts or questions for Jonathan as we wrap things up here?
Jonathan, I just commend you on the laser-like focus that you all have on mission and serving the church. And it's just very encouraging to hear about. And we wish you blessings on your continued labors.
Thank you guys very much. That's really encouraging. And I appreciate the opportunity to talk about these things. I think they're important for the future health of the church.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, thanks again, Jonathan, for coming on and talking to us about Greenville and seminary education and many other things. Is there any social media we need to direct them to? That's always a parting thing you're supposed to do these days.
Right. I'm not on social media. I don't have personal accounts, but the seminary does. And okay. So all the regular social media channels, I'll probably miss a few, but Twitter and Facebook and Instagram, and, you know, I'm sure there are 12 others that I don't know about. I think we're on. And again, if you type in Greenville Seminary or with the website is gpts.edu, I think even at the bottom of the website page, there's a place you can click to get access to social media. And then YouTube, you can get those videos and a bunch of other shorter videos as well. And I think you just do that by Greenville Presbyterian Theological Seminary. I think that's our YouTube page.
Very good. Yeah, the Greenville is online. I do follow them. That may lose you followers now. But there's no classic Greenville in tweeting. So anyway, thank you again, Jonathan, and thank you, listeners, for listening to us discuss this important stuff, both about Greenville and all the other topics we've covered. Do, of course, subscribe to the podcast so you don't miss our episodes with special guests like Jonathan. Until next time, God bless.
You can find American Reformer on the internet at www.americanreformer.org or on x.com, formerly Twitter, at AM Reformer. Don't forget to like, rate, review, and subscribe to this podcast. Please consider supporting us today by making a tax-deductible donation through our secure online donation portal at AmericanReformer.org. That's AmericanReformer.org.